Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index with me, David Taylor, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. Morning, Phil.
Morning, David. How are things with you?
Oh, not bad. It's a bit normal here. We've got a bad case of...
Normal's good, isn't it?
Normal's good. Well, normal is getting a bit boring, unfortunately, and we've got a house full. I mean, all three offspring have been locked down with us since Christmas because they came back for Christmas and couldn't get away again. So we've got a bad case of cabin fever spreading throughout the household at the moment, but we've just got to suck it up, I suppose, and hope that things change next month.
Do you want to hear my big news?
Yes, please.
The end is in sight. I had my first vaccination on Monday.
Really?
Very exciting.
You're not even as old as me. How did you get yours first?
No one's as old as you. I just think they're really efficient around here.
Probably. Actually, my daughter says that one of her friends, who is in her mid-20s, has been vaccinated. And I think it might be because it depends very much on where you live. A certain amount of vaccine gets distributed to various different locations. And once they've used up what they need to use up on the priority cases, they then say, you know, any more for any more. And so if you happen to be in line, you can go along and get your jab. At least that's the way I think it works. I'm not sure. But I certainly haven't had mine yet.
Well, it's put a spring in my step.
Good. And a needle in your arm. Okay, well, look, this week we've got another guest joining us for the podcast. And before we introduce him, I wanted to discuss a story that you posted on the website a couple of days ago under a headline that really caught my eye, which was, "Does Highways England really have no duty of care to motorists?" And of course, I thought, surely it does. And who says it doesn't? Well, I know you have the answer to that.
I do. They're barrister, apparently. Quoted in the press, this chap, Nicholas Chapman, Highways England's barrister, came out at a coroner's inquest into the death of a woman killed on the M1 when she got out of a broken down car, having waited a while to see if anyone was going to rescue her. No one did. She got out and terrible, terrible incident, and not the only one of its kind. There's been a lot in the press lately about... smart motorways and coroners and senior police chiefs saying time to have a rethink on smart motorways. And Highways England defence is we have no duty of care to motorists. We don't have to keep an eye on free-flowing traffic to make sure that no one's broken down. It's not our job.
That's astonishing.
It's absolutely astonishing. And I thought that can't be right. And I thought it was worth giving a bit more oxygen to this claim.
Tell us some of the background then, because I know this is a topic that is very close to your heart.
I think it's close to the heart of anyone who uses roads.
Anybody who uses the motorway network, yeah, you're probably right.
But I looked at, on the back of this, I dug out the Highways England licence to operate that it was issued with by the Department for Transport in 2015 when Highways Agency became Highways England. And reading that, it does really become a template for privatisation, if you like. It sets a framework of it, of a quasi-private organisation, Highways England, even though it's absolutely still an arm of government at the moment. And the licence to operate, it's subtitled, Guidance and Duties, I think. Highways England licence, Secretary of State for Transport, statutory directions and guidance to the Strategic Highways Company. Now, that's the key, directions and guidance. Now, everything about duty of care to motorists is not direction, it seems, but guidance. It says that Highways England should have regard to safety. It should ensure it does all these things. It doesn't say it must. And therefore, that gets it off the hook. And when I wrote that piece, that was as far as I went. But then it occurred to me, hang on a minute, there's got to be some other legislation that local authorities are subject to. And so I had a look at the Highways Act 1980, and I might need to revisit the article that I wrote, Does Highways England Have a Duty of Care to Motorists? Because I reached the conclusion, well, clearly it doesn't, shockingly. But actually, the Highways Act 1980 does say, paragraph 58, or section 58, or whatever you want to call it, in an action against a highway authority in respect of damage resulting from their failure to maintain a highway maintainable to the public, blah, 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 it has to prove that the authority had taken such care as in all the circumstances was reasonably required to secure that part of the highway to which the action relates was not dangerous for traffic. In other words, the Highways England, under the Highways Act, I think it has to be able to prove that smart motorways are not dangerous to traffic. And therefore, there is, it seems to me, I haven't read the whole thing or taken legal advice on this, but it does seem to me that the Highways Act 1980 might actually present a duty of care. So if I was arguing against Nicholas Chapman, that would be the document I'd be getting out to Waverton rather than the Highways England licence. The Highways England licence appears to be a get-out-of-jail-free card for Highways England.
Well, exactly. The wording is very subtle, isn't it? And I noticed that Highways England has a duty to safeguard the safety of the network. And as you pointed out, not the safety of the people on the network, just the safety of the network itself. Yes, exactly. Yes, which is, I suppose, a lawyer would be on that, all over that, like a rash. But it's this whole question about the safety of smart motorways is, I think, really gathering steam because there's a campaign against smart motorways now, of course, which is something set up by families of victims. People, I mean, 38 people have been killed on smart motorways in the last 5 years.
To be fair, 38 people were probably killed on dumb motorways in the previous.
That's true. I suppose the question is, were they killed when they broke down in the hard shoulder, which of course is now a running lane, which I think would be clearly the fault of the smart motorway concept. And I also read another report, which apparently Edmund King, who's the chief executive of the AA, said, as far as he's aware, there are only 8 people monitoring 450 remote cameras on smart motorways in Yorkshire and the North East region, which is where this accident happened. This woman who was killed, the one that you alluded to earlier, she broke down on the inside lane, which used to be the hard shoulder, and she was in the passenger seat. Her husband was driving. He got out. 16 minutes after they broke down, another car careered into the back of them and she was killed. You know, 16 minutes in which somebody should have noticed that there was a broken down car there and responded, or at least done something about it, but nobody did. So clearly the whole motorway, smart motorway setup is, you know, pretty rickety, is not working.
And other motorists, of course, are not allowed to use their telephones to ring up the authorities and say, you need to get out here, there's a problem.
Yeah, so of course.
We can't, you know, us fellow motorists can't raise the alarm. And Highways England aren't, they say it's not our duty. We've got no responsibility to watch out and to keep an eye on things. There was supposed to be automatic detection, but we've since learnt out that hasn't gone in hardly anywhere. So it's a mess.
And there's a hidden agenda that you hint at here, isn't there? Because we have the technology. We can see what's going on these motorways. We can modify or Highways England at least, can change and modify the speed limits to even out congestion, that kind of thing. Everything's being watched. Everything can be seen, if somebody's watching, that is. And as you say, all this infrastructure is perfect for the ultimate privatisation of the road network and the introduction of tolls.
They don't have to privatise it to introduce tolls, of course.
Well, that's true.
As we know, what was the figure I quoted, 27 or 29 billion pounds a year that the Treasury gets from fuel duty, that when we're all driving electric cars, that will go, and that has to come from somewhere. And that, presumably, is going to come from tolling the motorway network, because we now have the infrastructure almost completely in place. We need said we. The Treasury needs smart motorway infrastructure in place. We can still have a hard shoulder. We can still go back to keeping the lane one empty, except for emergencies. Keep that for refuge.
Yeah.
But although they'll have to do a lot of rejigging of exits, I suppose. I think there might be problems there. But that clearly is where the revenue stream is going to come from. I've asked this question several times of Highways England. Is it the same technology that they would need for automatic collection of road tolls? They won't answer that question. They only say, that's not our policy. Talk to the Department of Transport.
Oh, right.
You ask the Department of Transport and say, it is not government policy to introduce road tolls. All I'm trying to ascertain, all I've asked is, do we now have the technology in place? No one will tell me. I've asked the people who put the technology in. They'll say, oh, we're not allowed to talk about that. We're not going to tell you.
Well, it's all unspoken, isn't it? And you can, because you know what the answer is going to be. I mean, clearly they don't want to stick their head above the parapet, because if they do say, oh, yes, this technology would be ideal for charging people to drive on the roads, then...
It's the same, it's the same stuff that's gone in at Dartford Crossing. So we know it does it.
Yeah, but the minute they admit that, then everybody will say, well, that's the agenda then, and there's no going back from that. So,
well, it is the agenda. People need to know that and talk about it.
Yeah, no, I agree.
David, let me bring up another item of news that we and everyone have been writing about past week or so, which is the other big scandal, Grenfell cladding. It's worth, I think, just, and we could talk for a full half hour on where we are with the whole cladding issue. But the big announcement last week from the Housing Secretary, Robert Jenrick, is that he's managed to get another £3.5 billion from the Treasury to add to the £1.5 billion the government's already allocated to support cladding removal from high-rise buildings. It's not perfect. I think it'll help a lot for people who live in buildings of over more than 18 metres in height, but there are a lot of buildings less than 18 metres in height who aren't going to, who will still have to pay for this, pay for the cladding removal themselves, the leaseholders in the slightly smaller tower blocks, although their payments will be capped at £50 a month. But for some people, that's £50 a month they can't afford. So the problem hasn't been completely solved, but it's gone some way. But I think the big story for the construction industry and for developers particularly is that it's going to be funded by a new levy on developers. So it'd be interesting to see what implication that will have. £200 million a year.
Yeah, I was going to say that provoked a bit of an outcry from the house builders, because I can't remember which house builder it was, but I don't think they're particularly focused on high-rise developments at all. And they're saying, well, you know, we build semi-detached houses, and why should we be paying a levy up front for the removal or replacement of cladding on the sort of buildings that we don't build? And I suppose they've got a bit of a point there.
Well, see how it pans out. It may only be for the levy may only be on tall buildings. So we'll see how it pans out. But I was particularly interested in an irony flagged up from a letter to writer to one of the big newspapers, who was complaining that his local authority won't let him remove combustible material from from his home, and his home has got a material even more flammable and dangerous than the sort of aluminium composite material.
Really?
A lot of people are very proud of their thatch roofs. He sees a bit of a fire risk and wants to change it to clay tiles. Applies for planning permission to the local authority, and they say, no, you've got a listed building, you're not allowed to do that. You have to stay in your flammable house, even though it's your property. You want to pay for it yourself. You want to be safe. Not allowed
yes.
to.
I heard, and in fact, I'd be delighted if somebody could put me right on this, but I've heard, and I've always been told, that if you've got a thatched roof, by default, your building is listed. Now, I don't know if that's true. I think maybe it works the other way around. A lot of listed buildings actually have thatched roofs, rather than the thatch actually qualifying them for the listing. But thatched cottages, thatched houses, they're always, they're part of, they're one of the more desirable parts of the built environment. They're part of the typically British architecture, and so I suppose that they're it's sacrilege to suggest that you should take the thatch off a building.
It would play havoc with the tourist industry, wouldn't it? Who'd go to the Cotswolds?
Yes, of course it would. But I think there are loads and loads of houses all around the country which were thatched once and no longer are. I mean, I lived in one once. It had Welsh slate on it when I lived there, but I found out subsequently that it was originally thatched because that's the way they put roofs on when it was built 250 years ago in that particular part of the country. It would have been thatched, but of course I don't know if there was a fire there or whether or not they were sick of replacing it every 10 or 15 years, but somebody somewhere along the line had taken off the thatch and put tiles on, slates rather, and it looked perfectly fine with slates on as far as I was concerned, and I was quite surprised to find out it had once been thatched. You couldn't do that now. Just can't do it.
Anyway, an interesting irony, I thought.
Yeah, I think so too. Now I think our guest is ready to join us down the line, so let's introduce him. He is Brian Berry, Chief Executive of the Federation of Master Builders, FMB for short, which is the largest trade association in the UK construction industry. I hadn't realised that, actually. So, representing, I think, something in the region of about 8,000 SMEs, small to medium-sized building firms. The FMB basically has two principal aims. Firstly, to promote the interest of its members, and secondly, to promote best practice, raise standards, and offer advice to consumers. It is also the prime mover, I think that's fair to say, behind the Licensing UK Construction campaign, which wants to create a scheme to license building firms in a bid to drive out shoddy workmanship and banish the cowboys. Good morning, Brian. Was that a fair summary of your aims and ambitions?
Good morning, David. Yeah, I think you've captured it quite well there, actually. I think the FMB has been on a journey over the last 10 years or so. We're celebrating our 80th anniversary this year, which is an interesting time to set up a trade body in 1941. But it was a time of the London Blitz, and the small builders in London weren't securing the contracts to repair London. So they banded together to form the Federation, and we've grown from a few members in London to become a UK-wide trade association. And I guess really it's been fairly traditional to about 10 years ago, and we, rather than allowing any company to join and get the badge, we've been on a mission really to strengthen our entry criteria. So we now insist on having an independent inspection to actually be carried out before you can join the Federation. And we've got obviously a code of practice as well to ensure we get the best in the building industry.
This campaign to introduce licensing, I can see why it appeals to the membership of the FMB, because of course you've got a membership made up of a large number of small businesses, a lot of whom are being unfairly undercut and their reputations sullied somewhat by...
Hold on. Unfairly undercut? Where's the evidence of unfairly undercut?
Okay, well, I don't know. I mean, so if somebody turns up...
The industry suffers in some ways from a poor reputation. We know that consumers are often concerned about having work done because of cowboy builders. A survey we did show that one third of householders delay having work done because they don't know who to go to. And I think the problem is that anyone in this country can call themselves a builder. There are various accreditations and schemes for other parts of the construction sector, but if you are a general builder, anyone can be a general builder. And I think that has been damaging not only to our part of the industry, but to the whole reputation of the construction sector, because people have this image of a sort of mud and boots sort of cowboy builder doing shoddy work. So we need to stamp that out. And that's where we've been talking about licensing construction companies to actually improve the reputation, drive up standards, actually promote training in the building industry. Because there are so many problems at the moment that need addressing, and they could be done quite simply by raising standards and having a bigger commitment, I think, to training going forward. And that's obviously, as we're going towards a low carbon built environment, everyone's going to need to upskill.
Yeah. But Brian, are we talking specifically and exclusively within the context of domestic building work, private citizens enlisting the services of a building professional, in other words, rather than, say, any public sector or large-scale commercial projects? The question which immediately springs to my mind is, who comes within the remit of this licensing scheme? Because I'm sure that you'll have a bricklayer who will come along and put up an extension for you, for a private individual, but might also be employed by the local education authority to do some brickwork on a school building or something like that. Is there a cut-off point?
It's a very good point, because we commissioned research in 2018. We commissioned Pye Tate to do our report, Licence to Build. And we brought together a whole range of bodies in the construction sector, for the Construction Products Association, the RICS, LABC, which Trustmark. So we had this discussion about actually the remit of licensing. So in the report, it suggests that all companies should be licensed, because the problem would be, where would you cut it off? Mm. I can understand, actually, the big problem where we came from at the F&B was about in the domestic sector, because that's where a lot of homeowners are being ripped off and having a negative experience with building companies. But actually, I think that the report argued it would be very difficult to, where would you have the cutoff point? So the report argued actually it should be all the way through. But it is a discussion we've had within the construction sector. There were, you know, lots of discussions about it. I mean, I think on balance, we thought actually it would be easier to do all companies, because the larger ones, they're already complying with all the requirements. And in your supply chain, everyone would be licensed, it wouldn't be a problem. And in terms of cost, it would be very small for the larger ones, and not too disproportionate. I think our report talked about £150 for a small company.
So it would be everybody from a sort of a sole trader right up to Balfour Beatty or Morgan Sindall, or the, you know, the big tier one contractors. They would all need to get licensed.
The report suggested actually it would be better for all companies to be licensed, because you might have a situation in the supply chain where you were unlicensed and licensed. Where do you have the cutoff point? And it wouldn't be onerous, I don't think, for larger contractors just to say that they are licensed. It's not going to be a disproportionate regulatory burden on a larger company, but it would ensure that the same standards are met right throughout, from the larger contractors right through to the sole trader. So you create a level playing field for everyone, rather than saying actually at this point that's a cutoff point.
That's a massive scheme. I mean, who would administer it, and who would issue the licences? I mean, presumably central government.
No. What we have said, no? Actually, in the report, there should be some form of single authority that could administer this. I think that what we are keen to stress is not to rip it all up, because there are all sorts of accreditations that exist. It's very confusing. We did try to map out all the various accreditation bodies, and it's just a spider's web, really. I don't think anyone's ever got to grips with it, really, about how they all interconnect. So rather than trying to disentangle all of that, you recognise all those accreditations. You would have a single authority at the top, which the consumer could go direct to that body if there was a problem with the builder or the building company, because otherwise we would never get this off the ground. And we are saying actually that the company should be licensed, it should meet a certain standard. And it provides, I think, that reassurance to a consumer. If things go wrong, they know who to go to. And then this authority could then contact the various accreditation bodies to say, look, what's happening? You need to actually check your members. So we're not trying to make this too onerous. We're trying to work within the existing structures of the construction sector, but create this level playing field and provide the sort of confidence and the trust and encourage upskilling that I think we're going to need.
But what would the sanctions be if somebody was found to be doing building work for, you know, people in his local village or something like that, and it turned out that he wasn't licensed? what would the penalty be? Would there be a penalty?
Well, I think it would be beholden really for the household or the consumer to check that the company is licensed, every having work done to your home. And if they're not, if it depends how they're operating. If they're trying to be fraudulent about it, then they would lose their license or they wouldn't be able to practice in that sense. So you will, it doesn't stamp it out 100%, because there might be people who will use a company that's not licensed to do work. But if things go wrong, that would be their fault.
Right. If you're a plumber and you tinker around with somebody's gas boiler, and you're not gas mark registered. Gas safe registered. The penalties are really severe. I mean, if the work you've done is found to be dangerous, you can go to prison. I can see the value of something like that. These are safety critical issues, but somebody putting up a brick wall, I don't know.
Well, it depends if the brick wall falls down. I mean, tragically, I remember a small girl who was in a pushchair who was killed by a retaining wall that fell down. So, there are lots of these accidents in the building industry, which give us all a bad name. 49% of SME building sites are deemed not totally safe by the HSE. That's what we're trying to address, really.
Let's get down to some detail on this, because I don't know whether you've read any of the sort of things that I've been writing about, Brian, but I've made it quite clear on record that I'm firmly against this idea for all kinds of reasons. So I'd like to put some of these, and I would love to come at them in some sort of logical order. I don't have that. So let's go scattergun, first of all. You talk about unhappy consumers concerned about the cowboys. But when Persimmon themselves conduct a report and publish on their website a report of their shortcomings and say that our quality is not good enough, would you take away the license? Would the licensing authority take away the license from a top 10 national house builder because it's delivering homes to homeowners, to first time buyers or whatever, with too many faults, with too much snagging? Would there be a threshold? Would you take away the license from a tier one FTSE listed construction company because it was up in court on corporate manslaughter charges? Would you? Grenfell cladding is often, the whole Grenfell Tower fire has been cited as an incident of why we need to address the building safety's in the spotlight. But I don't understand how a builder's license would have prevented Ryden using the particular cladding system that it used. A builder's license has got no relevance to the whole Grenfell debate, which I think is the most pressing issue the construction industry faces, which is nothing to do with what you're talking about of cowboy builders. And so there seems to be a conflation of the broad big picture construction industry skills and driving out the cowboy builders. And cowboy builders is this term which we don't even quite know what it means. Do we mean crooks or do we mean incompetent? Because they're not the same thing. They're perfectly lots of, perfectly honest builders who perhaps persuaded to take on a little bit more than they can chew and maybe come a cropper. And there are out and out crooks out there. Why is the solution not just encourage consumers to recognise the FMB badge, and if you've got some domestic work that you need doing, use an FMB member, and the FMB will induce you, encourage you to do that by standing behind the member, and we as an organisation and our insurers will guarantee you satisfaction. Isn't that a much cleaner, simpler solution that achieves everything you're trying to achieve?
Well, we only have got a small proportion of the construction companies in the building industry, and so consumers are playing Russian roulette to a certain extent, because they're relying on online checks. You'd hope they come to us for one of our members, but most companies don't belong to a trade association, so they don't feel the need to. So 55% of consumers have reported that they're not satisfied in some form with the work that they receive. That's a very high level. So the licensing is trying to protect the consumer from these things. And obviously there's a need to upskill our workforce as well. So all we're trying to do with the licensing is improve the reputation of the building industry. We're actually trying to say all the good companies, and most companies are good, They probably need a bit more training just to get up to the required level. So I think in our survey, 77% of our members said this was a good idea in terms of licensing. The Grenville thing is a much more complex issue, as you rightly said, Phil, going forward. So all we're trying to do is actually say there is a problem with the reputation of the building industry. We're trying to do our bit to raise the standards, upskill those who work within it and equip it. Because actually by doing that, it becomes more, the standards increase and the reputation improves and we become more productive, because that's going to be essential in the years going forward about the productivity within the building industry.
But if you promoted FMB membership as the anti-rogue trader organisation, you could drive up your membership from 8,000 to 800,000. All those self-employed people would... You'd be almost like... Because let's face it, most people in the building trade are... Or certainly, I think about 50%, I should say, rather than most, are self-employed in one way or another, whatever self-employed means these days. And those self-employed jobbing builders aren't going to join the trade association because they don't see themselves as a company who needs to be part of it. But there is... I think a market for an organisation which encompasses a trade union, it encompasses a trade association, it encompasses Checker Trade and all those other sort of money-making, you know, business development type organisations. And if everyone who owned a home knew that the place to go to find a reputable builder was not Google or Checker Trade, but to FMB or some other similar organisation, which does what you do and actually has a threshold for membership, and presumably you throw people out of your organisation. I'd be interested to ask you about, but okay, excellent. That suggests some sort of standards being maintained. And if people knew that and you had more members, it would be a virtual circle, wouldn't it?
The onus is then on the consumer rather than on the supplier to...
As it already is.
Yeah, which is fine. But there will always be people who don't get the message, and there will always be people waiting in the wings to come along and prey upon them. I suppose Brian's view would be, and of course, Brian, you can tell me if I'm wrong, that... If you tell people that you need to see a license before somebody can do building work for you, that's a much simpler and straightforward cut-off point. They've either got the license or they haven't. And if they haven't got the license, you don't use them. I mean, is that the basic advantage?
I think you're absolutely right. Because at the moment, if we just relied on a trade body such as the FNB, it's voluntary. So companies won't join. So the report, the Pie Take, talks about it being mandatory. So you get a complete level playing field. And you're right, the onus on putting it back onto the consumer. There are people who don't know who to go to. What about the elderly, those who are more vulnerable in society? These are the people that tend to be ripped off and have a very bad experience. I mean, sadly, it happens all the time, and there's too much in the media about it. And that's what we're trying to stamp out. And this is not over-regulation, because if you are going to a doctor or a dentist, you want to make sure they've been checked. But if you're having building work done, it's very difficult for a homeowner to think, actually, how good is that company? And what happens if it goes wrong? You know, you have to go to trading standards or take legal action yourself, which makes it a very torturous and painful process. Mm. So in a nutshell, that's what we're trying to stamp out.
There are jurisdictions, aren't there, where licensing already exists. I think down under in Australia and New Zealand, for example, they have licensing down there. I don't know anything about that, but presumably you've looked into it. Does it work smoothly? Does it have the desired effect?
So we could probably do some more research, to be honest, about how it does work in other countries. But the Pie Take report talks about America, and in America, Australia, in Germany, in the Netherlands. They differ in how they operate, but it's broadly the same principle about some form of licensing approach to companies, which seems to work well. We know Germany's got, you know, builders in Germany are much more highly prized because they've got this tradition of highly skilled builders in the sector. We need to get to that level, I think, because there has been the last 20, 30 years a sort of lowering of standards. We've seen it with, you know, reduced apprenticeships, which is not helpful. We need to get back into... People should take pride in wanting to join the building industry. It shouldn't be a last resort. We need to get people enthusiastic about come and join us. And it's the small companies, of course, who train 71% of all the apprentices in the building industry. Mm. And move away from going to university and having pride to say, I'm an apprentice, I'm proud to be joining the building industry.
But this has been a long-running sore for the construction industry forever, basically. And 20 years ago or so, the way it was seen was to address this was not just in construction, but all trades, if you like, was the whole National Vocational Qualification movement. That was meant to professionalise, give a professional route to whether you're a hairdresser or a builder, but any non-professional trade that you could have you could become a profession. There are all kinds of NVQs in the building trade. Why, instead of saying you must have a licence to trade, why not just say, well, an NVQ is a badge of competence. Why not just make an NVQ up to a certain level mandatory? That already exists, the framework's already there. What would be wrong with that approach?
Well, that would be the individual, and then the company who doesn't deliver the level.
But
of
if the company can
required.
Only employ, I don't care if the boss of my company can't do it. I'd care about who he sends to do or she sends to do the job. It's the person actually putting up the bricks. I want to be able to do it.
Of course, you want to demonstrate. The company needs to be able to demonstrate competence that actually what it's advertising to do, it can be done well. So anything that improves standards of individuals is obviously a really good thing. And we argue that actually apprenticeships should go to a higher standard. But what we're talking here is about the performance of the company, so that the consumer knows who to go to, that they know that actually the work's been contracted with the company, and if it goes wrong, they would go to the licensing authority. It provides a clear route for people who have a negative experience with a building company. So I think what we're proposing is trying to simplify that for the consumer to make it much easier in terms of redress.
NVQ, why doesn't an NVQ do that? Isn't an NVQ already a license of competence?
For the individual, we're talking about companies in terms of trying to protect the consumer, because that the contract would be between the company and the client.
Yes, but if the company is only allowed to put people into your house, onto your property, who have got a relevant NVQ, job done.
Well, I think our approach is probably simpler, because companies will have a range of people in working for them. Some will be apprentices. I think our approach makes it much more straightforward in that contractual terms between the company and the client.
How do you think the Green Home Grant's going?
There are problems there.
Why? What do you think the problems are with the Green Home Grant scheme?
The government announced it. It was a job creation scheme, and then discovered actually there weren't enough people to do the work. Mm-hmm. So it's a shame it wasn't a bit more joined up. And certainly it's not proved very attractive to my members. We've only got three who've become PAS 2030 accredited, even though we've provided a route for them to do it. So it's not been great from that point of view. And what worries me is that the government is looking at this and thinking, it's not working very well. You know, the industry's not responding. What we need is a longer term view about retrofitting our existing building stock. I've always been concerned that we've had a piecemeal approach, various government initiatives, testing it and then stopping. And of course, the Green Homes Grant scheme is only a year or so. So that's not a particularly strong incentive for a small company to become PAS 2030 accredited, given the expense and time, only to know that actually it's going to end next year. So there needs to be a longer term view.
Do you not think that part of the problem with the Green Homes Grant scheme was a requirement? Well, two problems. One, a requirement for installers to be effectively licensed, to have a license, as I believe the FMB envisages it to be, and because of that it failed, and secondly because there was this bureaucracy of running it, this American style, have a capital or something.
No, I think the Green Homes Grant scheme, my understanding is you need to be PAS 2030 accredited to be participate in the scheme. So that's not a license.
What is PAS 2030
or trustmark
or trust stuff. I thought it was trustmark. What's PAS 2030, Brian?
Well, that sets the standard, what is required in terms of actually managing the work. So it's a sort of making sure that you can process all the work within your company to make sure it's up to the required standard. So this is, they're going to update it. It's going to be PAS 2035, I think, moving on, which would require a coordinator, a retrofit coordinator, to oversee the work. Because it's a much more complex thing, isn't it, in terms of retrofitting your home. All the trades need to understand how they interrelate, which is why there would be a need for a retrofit coordinator to manage all the trades coming in to tackle the insulation of your home.
So bureaucracy. It's just hugely bureaucratic, isn't it?
This is public money going into people's homes. We want to avoid, you know, because no one's licensed, you've got the probability of companies taking advantage of this and saying, oh, I can insulate your home, don't worry, I'll get up on the back of a ladder and do it and claim the money from the government. There needs to be accountability for public money going into the building industry. That makes perfect sense. And the people doing the work need to be competent to do the work, to carry out the function. So it is bureaucracy, but in terms of actually trying to maintain standards and protect the consumer as well as protect the taxpayer. But my issue is that this is a one-off initiative. We need a longer-term approach to retrofitting our building stock, because 85% of it will still be standing in 2050. And unless we tackle our existing building stock, we have no hope of delivering zero carbon. 20% of our carbon emissions come from our existing building stock. So the heat and building strategy, which we're waiting to see, you know, it's great to heat your home more efficiently, but if it's leaky, it's going to rather undercut the whole outcome. So that's why we need to do a fabric first. You know, our homes need to be less leaky. Otherwise, all the heat you put in it will just go.
Brian, I apologise that it's my fault. We've moved on to another different, equally interesting topic, which I do want to talk about. But going back to the licensing scheme, could you fill us in on where it's at? Because we reported last autumn that you had announced that you were making a tactical pivot away from, temporarily away from pushing the licensing scheme that you were lobbying for, because you felt the tide of change was not in your favour, towards supporting Trustmark registration. Where are we now? Your campaign, where's it at? Do you have ministers on board, do you feel? Do you have, you've got observers from the Department of Business on the task force. Are they saying, oh, do shut up, you're getting boring now? Or are they saying, this is really quite interesting, keep going?
Everyone finds it interesting. I think everyone's listening to and watching what we're doing. So we're meeting regularly to discuss the proposal. Last year we met, and we're not abandoning the principle of licensing. But last year, of course, the COVID pandemic, and that obviously all the focus was actually on recovery. How do we get through this? And that's ongoing. And you can understand the pressure on government to actually focus on that. So we took the view that actually to go in hard saying we want this licensing proposal to happen now would not be the best time when we're in a national crisis, the likes of which we haven't seen since the Second World War. But we have not abandoned the campaign. We will continue to argue for licensing. The industry is still interested in the concept, and we are still meeting on a regular basis to see what can be done. But we're also realistic to know that the government's attention is very much focused on the economy, getting job creation and getting us back onto our feet, which is going to take a long time.
Do you think that it's a matter of priority that the government, you know, your campaign has basically slipped down the priority list because of COVID and other pressing issues? Or do you think it's that the government just doesn't have much of an appetite for this sort of scheme?
Well, it's interesting, is it? Because we were talking about the Green Homes Grant Scheme. The government put the requirement in to be Trustmark Powers 2030 accredited. So that's some form of regulation. We're waiting now for the heat and building strategy. We know that the government is very committed to tackling climate change, which means looking at the building industry and buildings that need to be retrofitted. I think there will become an increasing awareness that actually if the government's going to put public money into the construction industry to improve the energy performance of buildings, there needs to be some form of checks. And increasingly that, to me, would argue moving towards the idea of licensing. But this takes time. You've got to win hearts and minds. There are perceptions about, you know, more bureaucracy, more regulation, whereas in fact all we're trying to do is actually improve standards in the building industry and provide value for money and, you know, create an industry that's fit for purpose in the decades ahead. So it takes time, as you know, winning hearts and minds, people who have entrenched views. So this is never going to be, we've got a campaign, so the end of 2021 result. It's going to take years, I think, to actually get this argument across.
So it's sort of baby steps. You need to do it by increments rather than just push forward for a full rollout of construction licensing next year or something like that.
Yeah, it's got to be, you know, we need to do more work looking at the report that was published and work mm-hmm. out more ideas to be more persuasive. But I think actually as people begin to realise as a spotlight turns onto the built environment as in terms of meeting our obligations for climate change and cutting carbon emissions, people will start to ask, how do we do that? How do we ensure that the people are trained and competent to do the work? How do we ensure that the public money is going to be used? We don't want a debacle of the Green Deal. The Green Homes Grant Scheme has been less than successful at the moment. So let's get away from that and let's move towards a framework that ensures high standards, consumer protection and value for money for the taxpayer.
In terms of a construction, like a license to trade as a builder, as a building company, as a self-employed builder, sole trader, where does gardening stop and construction building start? Where does decorating stop and building start? If I have a decorator come in and I say, oh, can you take the door and window furniture off and paint them properly so that you're not painting around the door handles? Oh no, that's building work, I'm not qualified to do that. I mean, are there some things, would they be allowed to put in a cat, would a decorator be allowed to put in a cat flap, or would that be illegal?
Well, I'm not sure anything would be illegal as such. That's a very good question. I mean, where you draw the line, and you're always going to get these arguments about actually, you know, can I put a nail into the wall or something, or can I paint this room? So we have said actually, as a broad concept, it should be about anything that alters the fabric of a building. But you will have those problems about, you know, the handy person going in who's just doing a bit of painting, hanging a picture. Provided that type of work is not altering the fabric of the building, then that would be classified more as a DIY, as you would yourself if you were reasonably competent, you would want to paint or hang a picture. I mean, we're not telling homeowners that you can't do that. You've got to have a licensed company to do that type of work. So we're focusing on the fabric.
You mean knocking a wall down? Is that what you're talking about?
Home extensions, okay. If you're doing, you know, new kitchens, bathrooms that require structural changes. But there will always be these grey areas that you can, you know, you can go down these rabbit holes and talk about them, but we're losing sight of the principle.
Yeah. I mean, DIY is one grey area, I suppose, because if it's your own building, I suppose you can do what you like to it within reason. But if you come to sell it, is somebody going to say, hang on, this wasn't done by a licensed builder? You know, it was done by a DIYer. Presumably, there's no way to legislate for that, is there?
No, I mean, hopefully any DIY person's not knocking down walls and changing the structure.
You know, well, I don't know.
We have got building regulations, haven't we, to protect all this.
Look how well they
that's
work.
True. Yeah.
We won't get onto the building regs today.
Isn't the real problem, though, the public image of the builder? It's not the odd job man who you're trying to get out of taking on more than he can chew so that your members aren't competing with someone who's cheaper because they're not that registered and they're automatically 20% cheaper. Isn't the real problem way beyond FMB's reach? It is Grenfell Tower. It is the Edinburgh School scandal. It is the shoddy quality of new build homes. And it is, you know, boredom, fat cat bonuses. I mean, there are much bigger construction industry problems which are dominating the front pages of the newspapers. And Cowboy Builders is always sort of ticking around in the background, but it's not the biggest problem facing the construction industry at the moment, I don't think.
Well, except that the informal economy is estimated to be worth £10 billion. 55% of consumers think actually the quality of the work they've had is not acceptable. One in three homeowners are put off having work done because they don't know who to go to. It is a much bigger issue than you realise. And that's not to take away from the issues you've just described, which are obviously enormous. But we do have a problem about the reputation of builders, particularly in the domestic area. So that does need addressing, because I think if you talk to the average householder, they would know or have experienced a problem themselves.
But if I knew that I could find an FMB registered builder in my area, not who's got a license, because I've got a driving license. It doesn't mean saying I'm going to drive under 70 miles an hour all the time. It just means I've jumped through the hoop of taking a driving test. It doesn't actually mean anything more than, God, 30, how long ago? More than 35 years ago, I happened to, you know, pass a driving test. If there's something more meaningful than that, which I think the FMB membership could be, or a similar organisation, you know, a private sector voluntary thing where consumers were educated, informed, put your adverts out in the middle of Coronation Street on a midweek night saying, this is how to ensure you will be happy with your building job, because if you're not, we'll stand behind it. But the unlicensed, the black economy is always going to exist. And I mean, I don't even know what the black economy is, because an awful lot of people... I have to do odd jobs, whether it's putting up a fence or whatever. I don't pay them VAT. There's no paperwork. I pay them cash. Sorry, I do. But I'm not obliged to submit a bill and invoice. Mm. And they're not VAT registered. They're obliged to tell the tax authority what they've earned that year. But I'm not obliged to pay an extra 20% and have someone in who's VAT registered. I can save myself 20% by having someone who doesn't earn over 85 grand a year. I don't think the licensing scheme will address or end the black economy in home improvements.
No, well, it might not end it, but it would certainly help stamp out a lot of this type of work, because homeowners would know actually using a licensed building company protects them, because as we spoke about earlier, if they're trying to sell their house, they would have all the paperwork to demonstrate the work done to their home has been carried out by a licensed company. And that might then have an impact on the financial lending who are looking to see if the work's been done by licensed companies. So, I agree, you won't stamp out the informal economy totally, but anything you can do to improve it, I think, would be really helpful. And really, the essence of all this is actually about protecting clients from the stats I've just talked about, really, because there is real concern out there, and that's where I feel it's damaging to our industry. I mean, it's a great industry we work in, but we don't want it to be tarnished by people who damage its reputation by not giving satisfactory service or competent work.
Where does that 55% dissatisfaction statistic come from?
I think that came from the report or one of our surveys, which I'm happy to dig out for you.
it's exactly the kind of statistic I think we should all be suspicious of. I think 97% of statistics are made up, including that one. I mean, my one.
Yeah. Well, you have to start somewhere, don't you? You have to base it on something. So otherwise, we can't work with the what we're trying to achieve.
I mean, I've read your Pie Tate report, and it did read, like so many reports of its kind, as an awfully impressively good job of giving their customer just what they wanted.
Well, I'm sure from their credibility point of view, that we gave them a free rein to do what they wanted in terms of the outcome. So I wouldn't want to be challenging their integrity. I'm sure their reputation stands and speaks for itself. So,
but that's the definition of a consultant, though, isn't it? That you ask them the time, you have to lend them their... Well, how does it go, David? You lend them your watch and you pay them for them to borrow your watch or something, and they'll tell you the time.
I don't know.
some definition of a consultant along those lines.
But yeah.
I mean, you do tend to find the answers you're looking for if you pay someone to find the answers.
Well, we gave them free rein. We didn't sit on them. I think Pie Tate, it's their reputation that's at stake as much as, you know, the FMBs. You can challenge it all you want, I suppose. You can challenge any report that you want to do. But we just have to start somewhere, don't we? And that's where we started.
I think Pie Tate did make the point, didn't they, in that report, that they said that they drew attention to Grenfell Tower and said that this is a sort of
that's when it all fell.
Yeah,
that's when exactly. That's when it all fell. As soon as I saw them talking about Grenfell Tower, I thought, "Sorry, Pie Tate, you've lost me."
Yeah, I thought that they took a wrong turn there, because I think I think it's fairly clear that it wouldn't have made much difference in the case of Grenfell Tower. And the whole question of health and safety on site, I'm not sure the licensed builder would be that much more reliable in looking after his own safety on site. Most small builders seem to do sorts of things that your average tier one contractor would wince at, but they do it on a regular basis because it's them up the ladder. It's not one of their employees a lot of the time.
I suppose, but look, we are trying to improve. We're coming from the point of trying to improve what's happening in the building industry. Otherwise, we just say, oh, it's fine.
Yeah. I get that, and I think that's admirable. I don't think you're coming at it from the wrong end. But what would it take to lose your licence?
Well, we haven't worked out all that, but you would need a range of sanctions, wouldn't you, depending on the seriousness of the infringement of what's been done. So, loss of life, maybe you'd argue you would lose your licence. But all that would need to be worked out. But I think there need to be a scale of requirements. And some of them could be quite positive. It could be asking the company to upskill, provide further training. And maybe that sort of develops into some form of competent person scheme, because we do need to have ongoing training in our sector. So I think that's a medium-term objective about, if you've got licensed companies, it's easier then to target them in terms of skills and training and provide a wider range of training that would benefit all of us. So that's why I think it's quite an exciting proposal to make our lives better. And that's where it's all coming from, really.
Can we return back, please, Brian, to the retrofit strategy, which I think is one of two campaigns I associate with FMB where I am fully on board with you, and I think you're doing great work. So tell us about what you're doing here.
Yes, well, the Cut the VAT campaign is something that's been going on for many, many years. And we've talked to both Labour and Conservative governments about reducing VAT. And, of course, at that time, the pushback was, well, it's covered by the EU. We can't do anything. Our hands are tied. Well, those hands are completely untied now. And we have been lobbying for a reduction in the rate of VAT. So now that the government's hands are untied, that they support small businesses, that they would like to see a dynamic economy, I'm looking forward to seeing what the Chancellor's going to say.
Because it's silly that I have to pay 20% extra to use person A to do some work than person B to do some work. I might much prefer to use person A, but that 20% can be a deal breaker.
Yeah, it's a huge amount, isn't it? And it really puts people off. And also, sometimes in our VAT studies, we've seen that it's cheaper to knock a building down and rebuild it because you avoid the 20%. And that really goes against the whole ethos of sustainability in reusing our buildings. So a bit more joined up thinking and less of the Treasury just seeing what can they get back in the first 12 months. It needs to be a longer term approach. But we are saddled by this system where the Treasury wants to see a return in the first 12 months, which won't happen. It needs a longer period. But it will, you know, I think all of us don't want to pay more taxes than we have to. I think it would really flourish, really help the economy if we cut VAT and get homeowners who have saved up all this money, if they've been lucky enough to have been working from home, to spend, you know, later in the year.
Yeah, I think more than 55% of listeners would agree with that, actually.
Brian, you're involved in the Construction Leadership Council as well, aren't you? What are you up to with the Construction Leadership Council, and how's that working out?
Yeah, well, I think one of the positive benefits, if there are any, from the pandemic has been how the CLC has pulled the industry together. So the task force was set up in March last year, and in my time, I've been working in the built environment now for nearly 30 years, and it's the best time, I think, where all parts of the construction sector have worked together in a much more collaborative way. So during the pandemic, the task force was meeting every day to talk about what was needed. I think the site operating procedures that were produced for the industry to enable them to carry on working was particularly helpful. The F&B produced guidance for domestic installers, which was approved by the COC. I think from this crisis, we've got a much better trust and understanding of each other within the construction sector. So that's a good basis, I think, for it to continue and to learn from that about how we can work on other issues. And at the moment, we've been looking at climate change and what needs to be done. So we've been looking at the idea of a 10-point plan. So rather than all these various reports, which a lot of people won't have time to read, the COC has said, actually, let's have something much more practical. Let's see what the 10 issues that the industry can focus on. And so that work has just started and we're working on that. I'm leading one of the work streams on repair, maintenance and improvement. So we've created a national retrofit strategy. All these things have come out of the COC. So I think it's been extremely positive, and I'm hoping that in the months and years ahead we can build on this, and it will change. It's organic, it grew up organically, and we can get this into a structure that will meet the needs of the industry and the country.
It has completely been reinvented, though, in the past 12 months or so, because it started off as almost like a sort of a CBIE, the minister and a few of his boss mates who, you know, may or may not have given money to the Tory party, sitting around, you know, no troublemakers, no unionists, no lobbyists, just business bosses. And now it's got every lobby group going except for the unions. Why are the unions not there? Everyone else is there.
Well, I think it's good to have everyone around the table, because everyone is...
No, I don't doubt that, but why not if you have everyone, why not the workers? Why not the unions?
Well, I think actually we have some representation on the advisors group. So I think there is representation there from the unions. The ethos of it is trying to make things work, trying to get our industry pulling together, because it is very fragmented. And, you know, in the past... It hasn't been running in parallel. It's been going all over the place. And I think a crisis does help people refocus and actually address the issues that need addressing. So I think the industry was well served, particularly last year when we were working together to actually help us get out of this mess. But I think the building blocks are there to create something more sustainable that will help tackle issues like late payment, the low carbon, retrofitting our homes. We've been looking at product availability. All sorts of things are coming up through the CLC, which I think working together means we get better results.
I think, to me, what's curious about the CLC, it is the way that you say, quite rightly, it has pulled all sides of the industry to work together and to come up and bang heads together and talk sense. And a lot of the work it's doing needs doing, and it probably couldn't have been done by anyone other than the CLC. So the output, no argument there. But and Build UK, sort of when it was created, bringing specialists together with tier one contractors, was sort of a movement in that direction. But of course it didn't have the house builders and the Federation of Master Builders and the National Federation of Builders and all sorts of other groups, but it had a lot of different groups. Construction Leadership Council, it seems to me, has got everyone in there. But it's also got government. One of the two co-chairs is also whoever the minister is that particular week or month. Mm. I think you must be on minister number 7 by now, aren't you, Brian?
They keep changing, not quite as often as housing ministers.
They're even quicker, are they?
Yeah.
But the secretariat is supplied by Department for Business, Environment and Industrial Strategy, BEIS, however you say it. And so that suggests that it's government run, government controlled, and somehow serving the government agenda, which...
No, I don't think... No, that would be a wrong impression. Definitely, it's industry-led. The task force meetings, these are issues that any of us can put forward that needs to be addressed by the COC. BEIS do attend the meetings, and that's helpful because they can actually pick up our issues and feed them back into government. We can use them as a sounding board to say what will work, what won't work. So it is definitely, I promise you, industry-led and not government-led.
Will the construction licensing scheme become a CLC, Construction Leadership Council, issue?
Philip, that's a great idea. Do you know, I must actually raise it at another meeting. So.
How well do you think it'll go down?
You're only here first, folks.
I'm sure there'll be robust discussions.
Brilliant. Brian, thank you very much indeed. I think we've pummeled you enough.
You have. You've actually taken an hour of my time. It was actually more enjoyable. I have to be honest, I was sort of slightly dreading it, but actually, you're much nicer in person when you see it.
No, I'm not.
He smiles when he punches you.
No, I'm not sure about you, Philip. I think David might be all right to have a drink with.
David never pays.
No, that's true. Right,
forget that then.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye, Brian.
See you. Thanks, Brian. Well, that was interesting, wasn't it? I still feel like I'm in a minority, David, being against the whole licensing scheme.
Sorry. I was being a good cop.
Everyone else seems to like the licensing scheme, or most people seem to like it. I have terrible fears about the bureaucracy we're creating. You thought the construction skills certification scheme had teething troubles? You ain't seen nothing yet. But no. I understand the reasons for it. I just think they're going about it the wrong way. But we'll see.
Have you spoken to any builders about it, actually, Phil? Have you asked any jobbing builders what they think?
Look, do you know what? A jobbing builder, the first thing that comes into their head is, oh, yeah, I'd love a license. I'd love to be able to something to show my mum that says I'm a good builder. So their immediate reaction is to say yes, because people do. They say yes, even the jobbing builder. Yes, I would really like a license.
Yes.
Said, and are you prepared to pay £200 a year for it and to have your work inspected and to fill in the paperwork and the form? Oh, what does it involve exactly? So it's all in the detail. Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Having said that, everything else the FMB does, I'm big fan of. Good organisation, mostly. but thank you very much, Brian, for his time. We very much enjoyed talking to him. And I think it's just about it. Although, David, I do have one other piece of business. And finally, okay. Esther, are you a Private Eye subscriber?
Not anymore. No, I haven't read The Eye for a long time.
I still do. I still read it. I won't say religiously, but keep an eye on it. Make sure that no one I know is appearing in it. Last issue 1540, a lovely spoof news item. HS2 works completed ahead of schedule. There was delight throughout Britain last night at the news that one part of the HS2 construction project has been finished well on time and under budget. The section in question is the tunnel from Euston Station to quite near Euston Station, known as the Swampy Line. they finished this 100-foot excavation for the cost of 99p, a trowel bought from Poundland. And it goes on, but that made me smile.
Nice one, yeah.
Right, that's all I've got. Anything more from you, David?
I think that's it, Phil. I'm ready to go. Get my lunch.
It is that time of day. Thank you, everyone, for listening once again to Reconstruction. Thanks to our special guest, Brian Berry of the Federation of Master Builders. David and I will be back again, same place, same time, next week, talking about whatever takes our fancy. See you then.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.